Welcome back to another deep dive.
Yeah, I'm excited for this one.
Me too. This is gonna be juicy.
Yeah, a lot to unpack here, a lot of interesting stuff.
Okay, so today we're looking at a Florida court case, Jenkins versus Eckerd Corp from 2005.
Right, yeah. Really, really interesting case, especially for anyone, getting into contract law.
Yeah, this
So
is a really good illustration of how, really specific wording in a commercial lease
yeah.
can have like huge real world consequences. And I think for law students especially, this is one,
Absolutely.
they should definitely pay attention to.
Yeah, because like we're talking about, this isn't just some theoretical exercise. This had, real financial consequences for the
Right.
parties involved.
So we've got the court opinions and analyses, and really, our mission here today is to kind of pull out, what are the key takeaways for our listeners?
Yeah.
And what can you learn from this case, especially if you're, a law student kind of navigating these waters for the first time? All right, so the story starts, back in 1991.
Okay.
We're in the Gulf Breeze Shopping Center,
Right.
and we have our landlord. The landlord is Sand Hill Developments.
Okay.
They sign a lease agreement with K&B. Now, K&B later becomes Eckerd,
Right.
but at the time it's K&B.
Yeah.
So they're signing this lease,
Yeah.
and there's this really important article in this lease that ends up, being the center of this whole dispute. Article 2B.
Article 2B, yeah, this is where all the action is.
So what was in this article?
Well, Article 2B, it was a co-tenancy clause, pretty common actually in commercial leases, and essentially it gave Eckerd, or K&B at the time, it gave them an out, a way to terminate the lease. And specifically, they could terminate the lease if a certain other tenant stopped operating or paying
Okay.
rent.
And so this was Delschamps, right?
Delschamps, yeah. Delschamps was the anchor tenant.
So, these co-tenancy clauses,
Yeah.
I mean, why do they even exist?
Right. Well, in a shopping center environment, the big anchor tenant, they're like the magnet, right?
Right.
They bring in the customers, and the smaller stores, they rely on that foot traffic.
Yeah.
So a co-tenancy clause, it's like a safety net for those smaller tenants. It says, hey, if the big guy leaves and my business tanks because of it, I don't want to be stuck in this lease.
Right, it makes sense. If the main attraction is gone,
Yeah.
the supporting acts are going to suffer.
Exactly. It's all about protecting those tenants who are counting on that anchor store to bring in the crowds.
Okay.
It's a power dynamic that's written right into the contract.
Makes sense. So let's fast forward about 10 years. It's
Yeah.
2001,
Okay.
and Delschamps, the anchor tenant, runs into a bit of trouble.
Yeah.
What happened with Delschamps?
Well, they declared bankruptcy.
Okay.
Now, they didn't just disappear from the shopping center altogether. Instead, their lease was assigned to another supermarket chain, this one called Bruno's Supermarkets.
Okay, so the name changed,
Yeah.
but there's still a supermarket in that
Still a
space.
supermarket.
Right, and this is important to remember
Yeah,
because
but this is crucial.
this is where things get interesting.
Yeah.
This is going to be the basis of Sand Hill's argument later on.
Exactly.
So what happens with Eckerd?
Well, when Deltrom's, or the lease for that space goes to Bruno's,
Right.
Eckerd decides to invoke Article 2B, that co-tenancy clause.
Yeah.
They basically say, look, Delschamps isn't leasing here anymore. They're not paying rent. So we're invoking our right to terminate.
Right, we're out.
Yeah, we're out. So they stop paying rent. And that's when Sand Hill, the landlord, says, hold on a second,
Right.
and files a lawsuit against Eckerd for breach of contract.
Right, so this is where you get the clash, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Two different interpretations of the same clause.
So they go to court,
They go to court.
and the first round goes to Eckerd, right?
Yeah, Eckerd wins the first round. The trial court issued a directed verdict in favor of Eckerd.
So can you explain what a directed verdict is in this context?
Right. So a directed verdict means the judge basically decided that there weren't enough factual disagreements for a jury to even consider.
Okay.
They looked at the lease agreement and said, based on what's written here, it's clear that Eckerd was legally allowed to terminate.
Okay.
So it's a decision based purely on the law, not on any disputed facts that would need to be sorted out by a jury.
Okay. So Sand Hill obviously, didn't agree with this.
Nope, they were not happy.
They appealed the decision.
They appeal.
What was their argument on appeal?
Basically, Sand Hill said, look, this lease wasn't as crystal clear as the trial court made it seem.
Okay.
They argued that the lease didn't anticipate the situation where the original tenant, Delschamps, is gone, but a similar business, another supermarket, is operating in that same anchor space under a different name.
Yep.
And they said, This creates an ambiguity, a hidden uncertainty that the original lease just doesn't address head on.
Right.
And so they wanted to introduce what's called parole evidence.
So for our listeners who, you know, maybe you're just learning about this stuff, what is parole evidence?
Parole evidence is basically any evidence outside of the written contract itself. Things like emails, meeting notes, or even witness testimony about what the parties intended when they were negotiating the lease.
Got it.
Okay. Things that aren't explicitly written down in the contract.
So why did Sandhill think this parole evidence would help their case?
Well, they probably believe that if they could bring in evidence from those earlier discussions, they could show that the real intention behind Article 2B, that co-tenancy clause,
right,
was to ensure there was a functioning anchor supermarket, regardless of the specific name on the lease.
Right.
They wanted to show that it wasn't just about Del Champs, the company, but about having a supermarket in that spot to draw in customers.
Got it. So they were hoping to kind of show that the spirit of the agreement, you know, the intent.
Yeah, the intent, the spirit.
Was really about the function of the anchor tenant, not necessarily the specific legal name.
Exactly. And they probably hoped that would convince the court to say, hey, Eckerd shouldn't be able to just walk away because the name changed, when the essential function of the anchor tenant is still there.
Right. Okay. So the question is, did the appellate court agree with Sandhill?
Well, this is where it gets, you know, even more interesting.
Okay.
The appellate court actually upheld the trial court's decision. They sided with Eckerd.
Wow.
Yeah. And their reasoning was really important. They basically said, look, if the language in the contract is clear and unambiguous, then we have to stick to what it says.
Okay.
And they pointed to the fact that Article 2B very specifically stated that Eckerd could terminate if Del Champs, and they used that specific name, Del Champs, ceased to lease or pay rent.
Okay.
And the court said, well, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Del Champs, the company named in the lease, was no longer leasing the space or paying rent, regardless of who took over afterwards.
Right.
So they said the condition was met, plain and simple.
Okay, and since they found the language to be clear, this is where the parole evidence rule comes into play, right?
Yeah, exactly. This is huge for contract law.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Absolutely. So the parole evidence rule, it basically says that if you have a written contract and it's supposed to be the complete and final agreement, what lawyers call an integrated agreement,
okay,
then you can't use evidence outside of that contract to change or contradict what's written down.
Got it.
The big question is always, is the contract ambiguous? Is the meaning unclear? If it is, then you might be able to bring in that outside evidence, you know, those emails and conversations, to help figure out what the parties really meant.
Right. Okay.
But if the contract is clear, which is what the majority of the judges in this case decided, then that outside evidence is usually not allowed.
Okay. And the appellate court didn't stop there?
No, they didn't.
They also brought up another part of the lease, the merger clause.
Right, right. A very important piece of the puzzle.
So what's a merger clause and how did it affect the court's decision?
A merger clause basically says that the written contract is the whole deal, the entire agreement. It says anything we talked about before this, any agreements we made before this, they don't count.
Got it.
It's the contract's way of saying this document is it. This is everything.
Okay.
And in this case, the merger clause stated very clearly that the lease was the entire agreement between Sandhill and Eckerd, and it superseded any prior agreements or understandings. So it was like the contract was shouting, what's written here is all that matters. Nothing else counts.
Right. Okay. So the appellate court looked at all of that. They considered the language of the lease itself. They decided it wasn't ambiguous. They saw the merger clause, which basically shut down any attempt to bring in outside evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they said the trial court was right to issue a directed verdict in favor of Eckerd.
Exactly. They followed the letter of the law, as it were.
Right. And they actually reviewed the contract interpretation from scratch themselves, right? What do they call that?
Right. It's called de novo review. So that means they didn't just defer to the trial court's interpretation. They looked at the contract themselves like they were starting fresh.
Okay. That makes sense.
It's standard procedure when appellate courts are reviewing legal interpretations, especially of contracts. They want to make sure the law is being applied correctly.
Okay, so it sounds like this was a pretty clear-cut decision, right?
Well, not completely. We did have some interesting concurring and dissenting opinions from the judges.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which is pretty common in appellate court cases.
So let's start with Chief Judge Kahn's concurring opinion. He agreed with the outcome, But he had a specific point he wanted to highlight, right?
Right. Chief Judge Kahn, he was all about sticking to the literal meaning of the words in the contract. He called it strict textualism.
Okay.
He was worried that if courts started allowing arguments about these hidden ambiguities, these latent ambiguities, especially in cases where leases have been assigned to someone else, it could create a lot of uncertainty and lead to more lawsuits down the road. He basically said, look, contracts are supposed to provide certainty. People need to know what they're agreeing to, and we can't undermine that by letting subjective interpretations run wild.
Okay, that makes sense. So he was basically saying, let's stick to the black and white of the contract and avoid opening up a can of worms.
Exactly. He was concerned about setting a precedent that could lead to a lot of uncertainty in contract law.
Right. Okay. And then we have Judge Irvin's dissenting opinion. He had a very different take on the situation, didn't he?
He did. He thought the assignment of the lease to Bruno's did create a latent ambiguity.
Okay.
And his reasoning was that, yes, the lease clearly named Deschamps, but it didn't specifically address what would happen if Deschamps' lease was assigned to another company.
Okay.
So he said, this is a situation that the original lease didn't anticipate.
Okay.
And because of that, he thought the trial court should have allowed Sandhill to present that outside evidence, that parole evidence, to try to show what the parties really intended. He was concerned that Sandhill, the landlord, was essentially being penalized, even though they still had a supermarket operating in the anchor space, just under a different name. He saw that as an unfair forfeiture.
So he was really focused on the idea that the spirit of the agreement was being violated, even if the letter of the agreement, the strict wording, was being followed.
Exactly. And he used this case as an example of how a seemingly clear contract can actually become unclear when unexpected events happen.
Yeah.
Events that the original contract didn't specifically address.
Right. And this really highlights the difference between those two types of ambiguity, right? You have the patent ambiguity, which is obvious just from reading the contract.
Right.
And then you have the latent ambiguity, which only pops up when you try to apply the contract to a real-world situation that wasn't clearly anticipated.
Exactly. And Judge Irvin's dissent is a great example of that. It shows how unforeseen circumstances can really challenge even a seemingly clear contract.
Yeah. So this case, I mean, it really brings up a lot of interesting issues, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's a great learning tool for anyone studying contract law.
Yeah. So let's just take a moment to recap some of those key concepts that we've talked about.
Okay, good idea.
We've touched on the parole evidence rule, we've talked about merger clauses, and we've also discussed co-tenancy clauses in general.
Right.
What's the big takeaway for our listeners about co-tenancy clauses? What do they need to know about how courts interpret them?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, co-tenancy clauses are designed to give commercial tenants some leverage.
Right.
They can allow for rent reductions or even lease termination if those big anchor tenants, the ones that bring in all the customers, decide to leave.
Right.
But this case shows that courts will generally interpret those clauses very strictly.
Okay.
If a co-tenancy clause is clearly tied to a specific anchor tenant operating under their original name, the courts are likely to stick to that, even if a similar business comes in to replace them. So the big lesson for lawyers drafting these clauses is to be incredibly precise with their language.
Yeah.
Avoid any ambiguity if you can.
Okay. And just to remind our listeners one more time, a directed verdict in this case, why was it the appropriate decision, according to the appellate court?
Well, the appellate court agreed that there weren't any major factual disputes that a jury needed to sort out.
Yeah.
The main issue was purely a matter of interpreting the lease agreement.
Okay.
And because the majority of judges found the language of the lease to be clear and unambiguous, they didn't think a jury was necessary.
Okay.
It was a matter for the judge to decide based on the law.
Got it. So ultimately, Eckerd won the case. And I remember reading that they actually even got some money back from Sandhill, right?
That's right. Eckerd had continued paying rent for a bit after Deschamps left, but before they officially moved out.
Yeah.
So the court ordered Sandhill to refund them that overpaid rent, which came out to just over $16,000. It really emphasizes how the court's interpretation of the contract had real financial implications.
Right. Okay, so for our listeners, especially those who are in law school, what are the big takeaways from this case? What should they be thinking about as they study contract law?
Well, I think there are a few key points to remember. First, and this is huge, Clear and unambiguous drafting is absolutely essential in all contracts, but especially in complex commercial leases.
Yeah.
Any ambiguity, even those hidden ambiguities we talked about, can lead to expensive and time-consuming lawsuits.
Right.
Second, merger clauses are powerful tools. Make sure you understand how they work and what they mean for the parties involved. They can basically shut down any attempts to bring in outside evidence later on.
Okay.
And third, remember that courts generally prioritize the plain language of the contract.
Right.
They're not going to be easily swayed by arguments about fairness or intent if those things aren't clearly reflected in the written agreement itself.
Okay.
So make sure everything important is written down and agreed upon in the contract.
Got it.
Hmm.
And finally, co-tenancy clauses can be really helpful for tenants, especially in commercial settings, but they need to be drafted very carefully.
Yeah, absolutely. They can provide a way out of a lease if certain conditions are met, but if the language isn't precise, those clauses can be ineffective.
Right.
So yeah, I think this case really emphasizes the importance of careful drafting, understanding contract law principles, and thinking about the potential consequences of ambiguous language.
This has been such a fascinating deep dive. I mean, I think we've really gotten into the weeds here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, it's a reminder that these seemingly dry legal concepts, they have real world impact.
Yeah, big time.
And this case is a perfect example of that.
Couldn't agree more.
So we dissected the facts. We talked about the legal arguments and the court's reasoning in Jenkins v. Eckerd Corporation.
Right.
It's a great case for understanding, you know, how clear language is so important in contracts.
Yeah.
How the parole evidence rule works and how merger clauses can really affect the outcome of a case.
And, you know, beyond just the legal mechanics of it all, I think this case also raises some interesting ethical questions.
Oh, okay.
You know, what happens when you have a contract that seems clear at first, but then unexpected events occur?
Yeah.
Events that maybe change the fundamental assumptions that the parties had when they signed the agreement.
Right.
You know, is it always fair to strictly enforce the terms of the contract, even when those unforeseen circumstances pop up?
Yeah.
I think that's something worth considering, not just from a legal perspective, but from an ethical perspective as well.
Right.
How do we balance the need for certainty in contracts with principles of fairness when things go sideways?
Yeah. That's a really good point.
And I think Jenkins versus Eckerd is a powerful reminder that words matter.
Yeah.
And in the legal world, those words can have a huge impact.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for another great deep dive.
My pleasure.
See you next time.